We have a real treat in store for us tonight. One of Canada's most important scholars on the subject of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Professor Eileen Schuller, received her BA from the University of Alberta in the Department of Classics and MA from the University of Toronto in the Department of Near Eastern Studies. She followed this with a PhD from Harvard University, granted in 1984, in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. She's taught in several places in Canada at the Newman Theological College in Edmonton, Atlantic School of Theology in Halifax, and since January 1990, the Department of Religious Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, where she's currently chair of the department. She's been a member of the editorial board of the Dead Sea Scrolls Discoveries, associate editor of the Dead Sea Scroll Encyclopedia, associate editor of HarperCollins Study Bible, and associate editor of the New Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. She was president of the Canadian Society of Biblical Studies from 1994 to 95. And most importantly, she's worked since 1980 with the international team for the publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls. She's known for her work on two manuscripts, 4Q380 and 4Q381, non-canonical Psalms, and it continues that kind of work. Between 1990 and 1999, she worked on publishing the six manuscripts from Cave 4 of the Thanksgiving Psalms. And these were published in Discoveries in the Judean Desert in 1999. Her current work includes a volume on prayers, hymns, and psalms from the Quran, from Qumran, excuse me, to be published by Routledge Press in the Literature of the Dead Sea Scrolls series, and a volume on What Have We Learned from the Dead Sea Scrolls to be published by SCM Press, the John Albert Hall Lectures, which were given at the University of Victoria in 2002. Her long-term project is a full-length commentary on the Thanksgiving Psalms from Qumran to be published in the Hermeneia series. Now, before turning the podium over to Professor Schuller, I wanted to just mention one thing about our program at the Canadian Museum of Civilization. We are a research institution, and we have a high level of expertise in a number of different topics that have to do with the history and culture traditions of Canada. However, in order to offer the public a wide range of information on civilizations of the world, it's often necessary for us to call on scholars in universities, scholars in other areas in Canada and elsewhere. And in this case, we went to Eileen Schuller and some of her students, notably David Miller, in Hamilton at McMaster University, and asked them for their commentary, for their advice, for their counsel in terms of our decision to bring this exhibition here. And she very graciously accommodated us and guided us really in the direction which has led to this wonderful exhibition, which has been so successful for us this winter. And I want to thank Eileen Schuller very much for having cooperated with us in that way, and to invite her up to the stage to present her lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Inglis, for that very kind introduction. And I do want to take this opportunity to congratulate publicly the museum for this wonderful exhibit, for the vision and the planning and the hard work which it has taken to bring the scrolls to Canada. I've really enjoyed working over the last 2 years or so with you on this, and it's a great privilege to be here this evening. In January, I came to the museum with two busloads of undergraduate students from McMaster University to see the scrolls. we were here early on one Saturday morning. The crowds were quite sparse, and I was trying to gather up the students in the foyer out here. And there were a couple of people going in to see the exhibit, and they were talking a bit too loudly so that I couldn't help overhearing. And just the usual things, how excited they were to see this wonderful exhibit, and that there was this great lecture series coming up. And one of the men was saying that he planned to come for the talks, probably all of them, except for that strange one on women. And he couldn't see why that was included, since everybody knows that there were no women at Qumran. Well, I did restrain myself from going up and introducing myself. But on reflection, I have to admit that his reaction was probably not so unusual. I mean, indeed, this is how the Dead Sea Scrolls and the site of Qumran has often been perceived and presented. That what we have here is a somewhat strange, small, esoteric group on the fringes of normal or normative Judaism. Men who fled out to the wilderness of the desert and adopted certain unusual ideas and practices, not the least being that they put all their property in common, lived a communal lifestyle, and did not marry. That they were male, celibate ascetics. Now, this basic conceptual framework for understanding the scrolls goes very far back to the first years when they were found. Let's see, we'll put this one up here. On April 12th, 1948, when the American School of Archaeological Research made the first public announcement about this astonishing discovery of ancient Hebrew manuscripts, they noted that one of the scrolls, and here they're talking about the rule of the community that's on display now, was a manual of discipline of some comparatively little known sect or monastic order, possibly the Essenes. So notice, within a year of their discovery, the authors of the scrolls were being identified, linked somehow with the Essenes, one of the groups or sects, along with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, that we know in first century Judaism. Now, previous to the discovery of the scrolls, our only source of information about these Essenes were brief descriptions in three ancient authors: the Roman writer Pliny, the Jewish philosopher Philo, who wrote from Alexandria and had probably never met an Essene, and Josephus, who claimed to have tried out all three groups before he chose the Pharisees to belong to. But all three of them emphasized that what was distinctive about this group of Jews was that they did not marry. Pliny the Elder described them in this way. He said, they lived to the west of the Dead Sea, a people unique of its kind, without women, without money, renouncing love entirely, with only the palm trees for company. Lovely description. Philo of Alexandria stated quite categorically, no Essene takes a wife. Josephus talks at some length about this. He says they disdain marriage for themselves, for they are on their guard against the licentiousness of women and are convinced that none of them is faithful to one man. But then, after going on at some length in this vein, Josephus suddenly introduces another order of Essenes, in agreement with the others on their way of life, usages, and customs, who do marry for the sake of the propagation of the human race. Now, precisely this aspect of the Essenes, men, unmarried, no women, seemed to be confirmed when the scrolls which Bedouin took from the first cave were read. The rule of the community, as you see it in the exhibit, was this rule book describing a way of life, rituals of initiation, a system of governance, a penal code, and it covers all aspects of life, but there's no mention of marriage, family, sexual relations. Indeed, there's no mention, no vocabulary related to women or procreation, except for standard biblical idioms, one born of a woman or the son of your handmaid. And in the other scroll that's on display in the exhibit from Cave 1, the war scroll, that detailed battle plan for the future war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, women are mentioned only once, and then by way of exclusion. No young boy or any woman at all shall enter the camps when they leave Jerusalem to go to war. And then in the 1950s, when the archaeologists turned the attention to the site at Kirbet Qumran, the physical remains that they uncovered there were communal buildings, a large centralized kitchen, a huge dining hall, and no individual family units. And when a portion of the main cemetery adjacent to the site was excavated, the results were the same. Pierre Devaux, the French archaeologist responsible for the excavations, wrote, and I quote here, "All of the skeletons in that part of the cemetery, which is carefully planned, the so-called main cemetery, are male." Though then he has to admit that some graves containing women and children were found more on the fringes, the outlying areas of the cemetery. And Devaux and subsequent scholars were never quite sure what to make of these, how to fit them into the paradigm of a celibate community. I mean, was this somebody's mother who came to visit and died? Or the housekeeping staff? Or, you know, some female tourists who got too much sun? You know, we had all sorts of explanations of this. So we'll come back to the cemetery at the end and look again at this evidence, which is actually even more complicated than it at first appeared. And so in the 1950s and the 60s, well into the 70s and the 80s, women were indeed absent from the world of scrolls scholarship. Whatever other wonders and knowledge might be gleaned from this newly found treasure, it certainly didn't seem like a source from which we could learn much about women in Judaism in this period. But now, in the last 10 or 15 years, the situation has changed slowly but dramatically. Of course, more and more scrolls have been published, now some 900 plus in total, and a surprising number of these treat women in some ways. That is, they either mention women explicitly, or they deal with topics such as marriage, childbirth, purity regulations, menstruation, or sexual relations. Now, because of the random way in which individual scrolls were published over so many years and by different scholars, I think it's taken a while to even realize how much material we actually have here. And it's only in the last 10 years or so that the topic of women in the scrolls has become a matter for study in its own right. If I can just mention my own experience here. Back in 1992, there was a panel at the annual meeting of the Canadian Society of Biblical Studies. And various people were asked to prepare a half-hour paper No, it was one of those panels where everybody gets half an hour. And they're on women in the ancient world. Women in the cult of Isis, women in the Christian church at Corinth, women in the Greek philosophical schools. And the chair of the session called me up and asked if I would present a paper on women in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then he laughed and he said, I could do whatever I wanted to do to fill up the last 20 minutes. Now, 10 years later, in 2002, at the big annual general meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature, I was asked to give the response to a series of five papers in a three-hour plenary session, papers that were given by leading Qumran scholars, interestingly enough, all men, on women at Qumran. And these papers will, in fact, be published in a few months in a major journal, Dead Sea Discoveries. And I think this is an indication that this is a topic of interest and importance for scroll scholarship per se, not just the special hobby of a few women with a feminist agenda. Now, I want to emphasize a couple of points as we move now to a more specific examination of some of this material. First of all, although the scrolls, or virtually all of them at least, well, I think we still have one more volume to go to press, but virtually all of them are now published, translated, they're, you know, digitized, you can get them on a CD-ROM. This is only the first stage of study. There's a lot more work to be done to try to work carefully through individual texts, particularly those that are very complex and fragmentary. One of my students just finished a doctoral dissertation where she took a single text, the Damascus document, and looked at women. And that's what we need, this very close, text by text, almost line by line study. And beyond the technical details, we are, I think, still trying to figure out the right questions to ask so that we can recover as much information as possible about women from texts in which the focus of interest is very often not women per se. And there are real limitations to what we will learn. So let me warn you at the very beginning. The scrolls do not tell us everything that we would like to know about women in this community or women in Judaism as a whole. There's certainly more information than we first anticipated. But the sources at our disposal are still limited, many of them badly preserved, and frustratingly incomplete. For instance, there are no passages that discuss explicitly or lay out for us what the authors thought about women and the appropriate role of women in the family, the community, or broader society. We don't find programmatic statements about the nature of women, such as in Philo. Women are selfish, jealous, beguiling, seducing, arrogant. Or what we read earlier in Josephus about the licentiousness of women. I mean, we might not like these statements, but at least we have something to deal with. In the scrolls, there's only one woman who's named in the non-biblical scrolls. Of course, we have the biblical scrolls and all of the biblical women show up there. But in the non-biblical scrolls, the only woman that's known by name is Queen Shalamsion, or Queen Salome, the Hasmonean queen of the first century. And her name appears in a very fragmentary calendrical text. It's a list of memorial days that are being celebrated. But the text is so broken that we don't even know whether the day that's being associated with her name was an occasion for joy or sorrow. We just really only have her name. There's only one text that I know where a woman is addressed directly. And this is in a brief wisdom type of text, you know, much like the book of Proverbs. Somebody's giving advice to an unnamed woman, and she's given rather conventional sort of wisdom type instruction about her relationship to her husband and father-in-law. And there's a very small group, a handful of texts, where a woman may be the speaker. One of them is this little text, 4Q502. Little text on papyrus. It's not really clear what this is. It's some type of a ceremony of great joy and celebration in which women are there, they're taking part. There's mention of sisters, old women, virgins, young girls. And in this one fragment, a woman stands in the council of the old men and old women, or perhaps these are elders that have some position in the community, male and female, and she seems to be saying a blessing. The editor of this text, Marcy Baye, thought it was a wedding ceremony. Others think it might be a New Year's festival. And unfortunately, all that's preserved are 344 tiny bits of papyrus, of which this is the largest. So we don't have a lot to go on. Now, I know my students get tired of me saying, we don't know, we need to study that further. But that's the reality of the material we're working with. So what I want to do this evening, in the time we have here, is to read with you some specific texts. So we'll start with texts, and then at the very end, we'll come back to the cemetery and the more material remains. Now, what are the important texts for our topic? Put a number of them up here. We won't go through, of course, every relevant text, I assure you. I won't try to do that in the next half hour. But there's a core of very important ones. And in terms of the genre or the type of texts, most of these are legal texts, regulations. We have these series of documents that we call a rule of life. Really quite a lengthy presentation of how this community sees itself, that it's going to live. And then we have, in the second part, there are more regulations, different types of rules. The temple scroll rewrites the law of Moses and gives a certain interpretation to it, including the laws about women. The 4QMMT, Mikset Maaseh Torah, is more of a polemical text. We think this, you think this, and some of the differences are about women marriage laws. We have the Tohorot, which are purity regulations of all sorts of different types, and then some sort of a collection of various laws, the ordinances, and they treat things like childbirth and, again, a number of texts that relate to women. Now, as I noted earlier, the first one, the rule of the community, is usually understood as the rule for a male celibate group, the yachad, as they call themselves, the community, perhaps living at the actual site of Qumran. And as we said, this text doesn't mention women or children at all. But then we also have, and in many copies, and in the different caves at Qumran, this third text, this long Damascus document, which gives regulations for what are called the camps. Communities that seem to be scattered throughout the land. They're living in proximity to non-Jews, conducting business with them. And yet there's some relationship between these people and the Yahad at Qumran, since this is all coming from the caves at Qumran. And in the Damascus document, marriage and family is simply assumed. And then to complicate matters still further, we have this other rule, the second one, the rule of the congregation, that was copied immediately following the rule of the community on the scroll that's on exhibit here. And it begins, this is the rule for all the congregation of Israel in the last days. And it goes on to talk about women and children, ages of marriage, and a lot of detailed material. Now, some scholars think that this was the earliest rule book when the group was just beginning. Other scholars, in contrast, read it as regulations for all Israel, as Israel will be restored at the end times, the Aharit HaYamim, at the end of days. So if so, that's interesting, because notice that the eschatological vision, what we're moving toward, is not a celibate male community, but all Israel, men, women, and children who will assemble once again to hear the law of Moses, just as on Mount Sinai, and when the community, the covenant was renewed in the days of Nehemiah. Now, one of the most complicated questions in Scholes research today is the precise relationship of all this stuff, all these different rules, to one another, to these smaller legal collections, and to the Essenes that Philo, Josephus, and Pliny were describing. I'm not even going to attempt to try to solve that tonight or to claim to, but it does seem clear that the scrolls are coming from a much broader movement within Second Temple Judaism, of which the specific group who lived at Qumran were only a small segment. I mean, perhaps this was a desert retreat for the elite, the most pious, or maybe a place where people went at the beginning for their training, or a time of withdrawal or retreat. I mean, remember that Josephus and Philo never mentioned Qumran or the desert, but rather described the Essenes as living in every town and village. And so I would suggest that most were married. And that's why we have no lengthy explanations about celibacy or even any text that attempts to justify abandoning the fundamental Genesis commandment to be fruitful and multiply. If there was a small group that didn't marry, and I think there probably was such a subunit, celibacy was probably undertaken for reasons of reaching the highest level of purity, or so that these special people would be always ready as warriors for this final eschatological battle. Because remember, in the Hebrew Bible, sexual activity is prohibited during the Holy War. But if these rules are going to be somehow read together, or at least they relate somehow to one another, perhaps it's not so significant that the rule of the community doesn't mention women explicitly. It doesn't mention the Sabbath either, or any Sabbath rules. But nobody thinks that these were not Sabbath-observing Jews. And there is a large segment in the Damascus document about Sabbath regulations. Now, what I'm going to do now is try to read with you a couple of key passages. I mean, I want to do this so you can get a sense of the type of texts that we have and the difficulties of interpretation. I mean, I'm not so concerned about every detail. We could spend the whole evening, or actually a whole course, on almost any one of these. But I just wanted you to try to get a little bit of a feel for this material. We're going to start with a very famous passage from the introduction to the Damascus document. And in the context here, the authors are defining themselves and their group in contrast to their opponents, other Jews who are not following the law of Moses correctly. And they say these people are ensnared in the three nets of Belial. Belial is their term for the evil spirit or Satan or the devil. And the way these three nets of Belial are ensnaring everybody else is very complex, not very clear in some places. But what is striking for our purposes is that it is over issues of who one can marry, particularly whether uncle-niece marriages are allowed or not, issues of divorce, issues of sexual relations. So note, all of these things involve women. These are the core of the community's self-definition versus the rest of Judaism, who are accused of following corrupt practices on these points. So if we take this first example, the builders of the wall are caught twice in fornication by taking two wives in their lifetime. So the bad guys, those in the nets of Belial, here they're described as the builders of the wall, take two wives in their lifetime. By implication, this community does not. Now, what's going on here? I mean, the phrase can actually be interpreted in different ways. In probably the most lenient interpretation, this becomes a prohibition of polygamy, not to take two wives at the same time. But having two wives wasn't that common in Judaism at this time, except perhaps in some of the very elite upper class families, and it certainly doesn't seem to be the defining issue. Most often, I think probably this is read in terms of divorce, or more specifically, remarriage after divorce, which is seen by this group as taking two wives. So that would mean that this community, in contrast to the Pharisees and then the later rabbinic tradition, forbade divorce, or at least remarriage after divorce. Not quite that simple, though, because there's other passages in the Damascus document that seem to allow divorce, at least under certain circumstances in which the consent of the overseer, the head of this group. The strictest interpretation would say that the passage forbids a man to remarry ever, even after the death of his spouse. Literally, men cannot take two wives in the man's lifetime. Now, which of these three things is at stake here? Whether this is about polygamy or remarriage after divorce or remarriage under any circumstances is still a matter of ongoing debate among scholars. I mean, there must have been 30, 40 articles written precisely on this by now. But even with all this uncertainty, we can still learn a lot from this passage. I mean, first of all, it's clear that issues of divorce were being disputed in Second Temple Judaism. Those caught in the net of Belial do one thing. This group understands that the law of Moses is to be interpreted in quite a different way. And notice that they appeal to biblical proof texts. They say, this is what it says in the creation story. Male and female, he made them. Two by two, they went into the ark. And perhaps some of you, you know, have already come into your mind the passage in the New Testament Gospels where the Pharisees come up to Jesus and ask him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? Now, before the discovery of the scrolls, scholars often viewed this as an artificial question, sort of a setup. Because after all, Deuteronomy takes for granted that divorce is allowed in some circumstances, and the different groups, the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai, debated about what was sufficient cause. So why should anybody go to Jesus and ask, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? You see, now we can see that this was a disputed question at this time. And in this instance, Jesus' more strict teaching on divorce was closer to that of the Qumran group than to the teaching of the Pharisees. But notice in all this discussion, and this is very typical how Qumran scholars approach this passage, the question that is not being asked is, how were the women of the community affected by this particular interpretation of the law? We note that the law itself, as most biblical law, most Qumran law, is formulated from the perspective of the man taking two wives. But if there was a very strict code about divorce, was this strictness perceived as a security for the woman? And she couldn't be easily tossed out? Or was it seen as a condemnation to abuse, what we would call abusive situations? If remarriage after divorce was not allowed, did this create a category of unattached women who didn't have a place within the family system? Who looked after these women, supported them? The German scholar Hartmut Stegemann has made the very interesting suggestion that one of the reasons that Josephus was able to present the Essenes as unmarried is because if many women died in childbirth young and the men could not remarry, a large number of the community would in fact be men without wives. So notice here, I've made the leap, in a certain sense, from this text to trying to reconstruct the social reality behind the text. I'm assuming that there were real men and women who were affected by these laws, that it wasn't just some utopian formulation. Now, this type of speculation, reconstruction, is always a risky business. We know that legal prescriptions can often be quite different from the lived reality. And yet I think these are important questions for us to at least start to ask. Now, I'm going to look at a second group of texts that illustrate a slightly different point. And these are all texts that talk in some way about sexual relations. I mean, what's clear is that there's no condemnation or prohibition of sexual activity within marriage, no suggestion that sex is inherently evil, or that female sexuality is particularly problematic. There's a concern for purity, and within the framework of the Levitical purity system, and particularly with regard to bodily discharges, but this applies to both men and women. But what we can note is that time and time again, when biblical laws are reinterpreted in a particular sectarian way, that is different, say, than the Pharisees would read those laws, the difference is almost always in the direction of greater strictness. I'll give you a few examples here. I mean, we have one place in the Damascus document that has this prohibition, exactly what it means. Sexual intercourse is prohibited in Ir HaMikdash, the city of the sanctuary or the holy place. Probably they're talking about Jerusalem. Maybe they're talking more specifically about the area just around the Temple Mount. But again, there's some issue. The holiness of the sacred site and sexual activity is prohibited there. Not everywhere, but there. And then as we go along in the Damascus document, there's one place where there's a long list of transgressors, as it's called. And it goes through the list, people who do X, 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 and X. And among the transgressors is one who approaches his wife. So notice again, it's formulated in the masculine. On the day of, and then the fragment breaks off. So, and this is often just the key point, that's where it breaks. Joseph Baumgarten, who edited the Damascus document, suggested restoring B'Yom HaShabbat on the Sabbath day. So that would mean that sexual activity for this group was prohibited on the Sabbath, whereas the rabbis praised and encouraged sexual pleasure on the Sabbath. Then a few lines later, there seems to be the statement, one who lies with a pregnant woman causing blood to stir. So there's a condemnation of intercourse during pregnancy. So the last phrase, causing blood to stir, it's not clear whether the concern is with purity or perhaps with the health of the fetus. But this reminds us again of a statement that Josephus makes about the Essenes. They do not have intercourse with their wives during pregnancy. And then the last example is from a little bit later, from a real penal code that not only, you know, says, gives the offenses, but tells you what the punishment is. And one of the most serious offenses is that of a man who approaches his wife to act immorally. This not l'ishto. And the precise nature of the offense is unclear, but some type of sexual activity between a man and his wife is judged serious enough to merit the most extreme of punishments, expulsion. He shall depart
and not return again. Now, perhaps all of these restrictions on sexual activity should be related to what Josephus says, that those who marry, marry not for self-gratification, but for the necessity of children. But again, I think, and it's interesting to ask the question, what would this mean for women? And particularly, perhaps, women who did not conceive or were able to bear children. Now, the third text I'm going to look at is a longer text. At least we have a bit more material here. Again, from the Damascus document. It's a passage about the selection of a marriage partner. And again, the regulations are formulated from the point of the view of the father who's charged with choosing a husband for his daughter. Although it's interesting, there's another text where the overseer of the whole community seems to have also had a role in the selection, which in a sense is a real restriction on the authority of the father. So both men and women in this community surrendered considerable personal autonomy to the authority of the community and its leaders. Now, this subject of marriage, this text comes up within the larger context of a series of laws concerned with fraud in carrying out business transactions. So that already tells you something of the framework where we're considering marriage here. The father is to make a complete disclosure of his daughter's blemishes, lest he bring himself upon himself the curse, and then there's a quote from the book of Deuteronomy. Notice nothing is said about the blemishes of the groom. And then we have, the next sentence is very interesting. He should not give her to one unfit for her, for that is kela'im, the mixing of two kinds, again, which is something that the biblical text talks a lot about. Now, what's interesting here is this expression, one who is unfit for her. Unusual. We don't have it attested anywhere else. Le'asher lo hukan la. So her husband must be fit. We're probably here talking about, you know, she must be licitly able to marry him, legal requirements, rather than some romantic ideal of a soulmate. Although we might recall that, I mean, probably the closest thing that I've been able to find to a phrase like this is in the book of Tobit, the story of Tobit, where Tobit is to marry a woman who was set apart for you before the world was made. Is that what fit for her means? I don't know, maybe that's too sentimental an interpretation. But let's go on. The next sentence, the man is not to bring a woman into the holy marriage or the holy community who has been sexually active before marriage, either as a young girl in her father's house or as a widow after she was widowed. So he's to marry a virgin. And any woman upon whom, if there is a bad name, which again is a biblical phrase, there is a suspicion that she is not a virgin, she is to be examined before marriage by trustworthy women of repute. Nashim ne'amanot v'yada'ot. Selected, these women are to be selected by the overseer. Now, this is a specific reinterpretation of a law from Deuteronomy 22. And there the issue is the husband who makes a claim on his wedding night that he's discovered that his wife is not a virgin. And if the charge is proved, according to Deuteronomy, the woman is to be put to death. Now notice here, the interpretation of this law really disallows that possibility. And in that case, is it somewhat of a protection for the woman? But for our purposes here, what I want to highlight too is that it is assumed that there will be women who have the expertise, they're knowledgeable to establish the fact of physical virginity. I mean, perhaps these were midwives in the community. and women who are accepted by the community as reliable. A note. The word here is the same terminology that's applied to a male who gives witness in a court of law. And that brings me to my last point, because our time is running out, just to raise the question of the role and status, the position of women in this community. That women were present is obvious from some of these passages we've been reading. But were women really members? Could they choose independently to join this group, to go through the same initiation rites and take the solemn oaths as the covenant as did the men? Or were they members only because they were born into the group, or they married someone who was a member? Did they exercise any leadership roles? I mean, my students always tend to pose this question, were they equal to men? And of course, that's a very modern way of asking the question. And equality is not a term that we're going to find in the scrolls. But there are a couple of very interesting passages that give us some hints of that women were accepted in a very serious way. And I'm going to just look at two passages here. The first one, we've already seen this one passage where women were being recognized as knowledgeable and reliable. This first passage here is from the rule of the congregation. And it talks about a woman being accepted, or perhaps accepting, to give testimony. And the word that's used here is the same word that's always used in a legal sense, to be a witness in a court of law. Concerning her husband, and the context of the passage has to do, again, with sexual matters within marriage. Now, when this passage was first read in the 1950s, the scholars who first looked at it were so taken back by a statement that a woman could give testimony that they simply amended the text. I mean, it's perfectly clear. It's not even fragmented or broken here. But if you look at the translations, even a translation, the latest edition of Vermesh's English translation, at this passage, it will say, until he shall be accepted to give witness. Now, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of study of this passage, and scholars even like Baumgarten, who proposed the emendation in the first place in 1958, has now publicly changed his mind and allowed that we have to read the text as it stands. That in this community, a woman in certain defined circumstances could give testimony, and her testimony would be accepted, at least in these circumstances. It doesn't say about everything, but in the context of marriage in particular. And then my second example here, very interesting text, again going back to this penal code. Whoever murmurs against the fathers shall depart from the congregation and not return. And if he murmurs against the mothers, he shall do penance for 10 days. For the mothers do not have, and then we've got a word we don't know what it means, in the midst of the congregation. Very fascinating text. I mean, you certainly seem to have this parallel. You have the fathers of the community and the mothers of the community. There's a major discrepancy between the severity of the punishment. Expulsion for those who murmur against the fathers, and a 10-day penalty. This is probably a food reduction for those who murmur against the mothers. And then we have this, you know, unfortunately, this final phrase, we've got this word that we really just don't know what it means. I mean, rokhmah or rukhmah, it sometimes means a variated colored cloth, and perhaps in some contexts in Syriac and Aramaic, it might mean something like authority or status. So we have this, you know, the authority, the status of the mothers is certainly less, and yet we have these parallel terms. There's mothers and fathers who seem to have some special role within the community. Now, we've been looking at a whole series of texts. I could go on and give you more, but they would be much of the same content and type. In the last few minutes now, I just want to return very briefly to the physical remains of the site of Qumran and see if we can get any more information out of that about the occupants, specifically women. Now, notice what I'm doing here. I'm talking now only about the particular site at Qumran, not about all the communities that lived in the camps, in the towns, and the villages, where they haven't left any material traces. So as I said earlier, when the ruins were excavated in the 1950s, the size of the large assembly hall, the 700 bowls in the pantry, the absence of small dwellings, all suggest that this was a place where people congregated and there was some sort of a communal thing going on. But are there other types of archaeological evidence that need to be considered? Particularly what we call small objects, distinctively associated with women. Often when you're looking for the presence of women, you look for beads, earrings, mirrors, jewelry, spindle whorls, if women were the ones who were doing specifically the spinning in antiquity. These are the questions what we call engendered archaeology really tries to look at. But the problem is that most of these small objects that were excavated in the 1950s have not yet been published. And so that's still an outstanding question that needs a lot more work. And likewise with the cemetery, this large cemetery of 1,200 graves. The normal practice in this period was probably burial in a family tomb, with, at least for the wealthy, the secondary collection and preservation of the bones in an ossuary, those boxes that you saw up in the exhibit. But at Qumran, the bodies were buried in the ground, in individual graves with a north-south orientation. So you probably rose up to face the north, which was where paradise was. Now, skeletons were found from 43 different graves in the 50s. Then they got lost, literally. For the last 30, 40 years, nobody knew where these skeletons were. Most people thought they had disappeared. And really, in the last 5 years, they were found, 22 of them in a museum in Germany, 9 in Paris, 8 in Jerusalem. And they've been restudied. And so we're looking at this question again. And what's become clear is that some of these skeletons on the fringes of the cemetery, remember where we said we had the women and children, are really modern Bedouin graves. And so they're completely irrelevant to our purposes. And in the main cemetery, there's probably maybe 3, some scholars, depending on, often these are hard to evaluate, some scholars would say maybe 5 or 6 females out of the 43 burials. A much smaller proportion than would be expected in a regular cemetery. So suggesting that this was an unusual community in which there was a disproportionately small number of women. But the proportion of the graves excavated overall is only about 4% of the total cemetery. It's statistically so small as to make any conclusion almost meaningless. So until all of the graves, or at least a really representative portion, are excavated and the contents scientifically examined, the cemetery, I think, cannot be used in any meaningful way as an independent source of evidence, either about the presence or absence of women at the site of Qumran. And now my time is drawing to a close. I don't have any clear-cut, dramatic conclusion for you, but perhaps that's a fair reflection of where scholarship on the scrolls about women is at present. It is very much a study in process. I hope that I have convinced you that yes, the scrolls have something to tell us about women. We rarely, if ever, directly hear the voice of women. These are androcentric texts written by men with their own agenda and concerns. What has been preserved is fragmentary and damaged, and probably much has been lost. But considering how little we know about women in antiquity, in both early Judaism and in the early Christian church, the ray of light that is shed on this particular sectarian group cannot help, I think, but illuminate the whole broader picture. And so, as a source of information about women, as in so many other ways, the scrolls have proven to be what W.F. Albright promised when they were first discovered, an absolutely incredible find. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Schuller. I think we have time for a couple of questions. Would anyone like to pose a question from the audience?
Yes, I'm very much interested with the subject. And I'd like to know if there's a book that has everything that's been found up there so far in a book, in one book or encyclopedia.
Okay. That's a good question. I mean, part of it is that much of this material, you know, has been published in articles and often in quite technical journals. Probably the best thing is the Encyclopedia of Judaism. I better be careful here. The Encyclopedia of Judaism has an article on women. It was written by myself and my students. But it has an article on women. It also has a second part, which was written by Hannah Cotton at Hebrew University, on some of the texts in the neighboring caves that we haven't talked about, at Mihrabat and Nahas Hever, that's very interesting also. And there's also a very interesting article on family life. So and there's an index at the back, which will put together all of these places where women are discussed. So I think that's a very accessible resource.
I wasn't meaning about women, but about everything that's been found.
Oh, everything, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there of course are many different introductions to the scrolls. I mean, there's some of the very classical ones that were written, you know, in the 1950s and have remained standard introductions from some of the very first scholars, Frank Moore Cross and J.T. Millick. Recently, Jim Vanderkam at Notre Dame wrote a very good basic, just simply called An Introduction to the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then in conjunction with Peter Flint, who gave one of the lectures here, he's written a larger book, which is an introduction more to the texts. He has less about the site itself. But those are certainly standard introductions.
John Vanderkam?
Yeah, James Vanderkam. Yeah.
Okay, An Introduction to
the Dead Sea Scrolls by Erdman's Press.
That would be the most complete one?
Yes, it's a very complete, a very accessible one.
Could we have another question?
How large was the community of the Essenes and how long was the community lived in? Hundreds of years or?
Okay. Yeah, now are you thinking about the site of Qumran?
Yes.
At the site of Qumran, yeah. Because again, as we say, if we're thinking about the other towns and villages, we have so little evidence. The site of Qumran, probably, you know, archaeologically, if we can try to figure it out, People moved there maybe around 100 BCE. It used to be said 150, but that's maybe pushing it back a bit too far. Some scholars would say 150. Jody Magnus, one of the great archaeologists on the site, would really push for around 100 BCE. And then people seem to have lived there up until there's a destructionary layer. So it was destroyed, and that's usually linked to the time of the Roman revolt, the Jewish revolt against Rome in 68-69. And in fact, we know that when Vespasian marched his troops into Jerusalem, he went by the site of Qumran, because it says he threw a couple of prisoners into the Dead Sea to see if they would float. You know, so at least the assumption is that that was the stage when, you know, whether they rose up in revolt against Rome or whether Rome just burnt the site, we don't know. Now, how large the community was is, again, very hard to figure out. Some people would suggest that maybe there was about 100, 125 people at this site. We have to figure out, well, where did they all sleep? And then you have to say, well, there must have been a second floor. Or some of the Israeli archaeologists have really made the claim they slept in caves around the site, much like the early Christian monasteries in the desert, and then came to this central place. Other people have, Hartmut Stegermann, this German scholar that I mentioned earlier, he would suggest a much smaller number, maybe 50 people. That's interesting. I'll just say the reason how he gets that number is he thinks that when these people prayed, they prostrated, you know, much like the Muslims do now when they pray. And he says they prayed in the dining hall. And I can remember one time when he collected everybody he knew and we had to go out to Qumran and see how many people could lie down in the dining hall. And he ended up with about 50. We really don't know. So.
Well, I think it just remains to thank our speaker, Professor Eileen Schuller, for a very stimulating evening. And thank you very much for coming tonight.